This is Michael Cowan, and welcome to Trial Lawyer Nation.
You are the leader in the courtroom, and you want the jury to be looking to you for the answers.
When you figure out your theory, never deviate. You want the facts to be consistent, complete, and credible.
The defense has no problem running out the clock. Delay is the friend of the defense.
It's tough to grow a firm by trying to hold on and micromanage.
You've got to front load a simple structure for jurors to be able to hold on to.
What types of creative things can we do as lawyers, even though we don't have a trial setting?
Whatever you've got to do to make it real, you've got to do to make it real. But the person who needs convincing is you.
Welcome to the award-winning podcast, Trial Lawyer Nation. Your source to win bigger verdicts, get more cases, and manage your law firm. And now, here's your host, noteworthy author, sought-after speaker, and renowned trial lawyer, Michael Cowan.
We're going to start a new feature on this podcast. It's Ask Michael and Mallory Anything. If you have anything you'd like to ask either Mallory or me, we're going to start doing an episode every couple months where we're going to answer your questions. So just send them in to me at michael@cowanlaw.com, and Mallory and I will answer them. Anything from, you know, legal strategy, marketing management, anything else in life you want to talk about, we'll be glad to talk about it with you. Again, ask Michael and Mallory anything. Just send us an email. We'll be glad to answer your questions.
Welcome to Trial Lawyer Nation. This episode highlights standout moments from 2025. We start with big verdicts and the lessons learned in high-stakes cases.
I have the privilege and honor, just like you do, of talking to great trial lawyers. And so over and over in those tips of the day and then talking to just amazing, you know, Randy McGinn and Rick Friedman and Bill Barton and on, Lisa Blue, what I hear over and over is credibility. When we look at Mo Levine's books, just over and over, credibility is the most important thing. And you just said it. And so lately, something that's just been really fascinating to me, and I love asking other trial lawyers, is what does it mean to be credible? I can give you some examples from this trial of where I thought it was very important. And I think everyone will agree, or most everyone, that credibility is the most important virtue or attribute that we have at trial. What does that mean? Is it honesty? Is it vulnerability, believability? And what gives you those things? I'm curious your thoughts on that before I give you maybe some examples of how I thought credibility worked in this trial for me.
Yeah, to me, credibility starts with trusting the jury, I've learned. And so it means I trust the jury enough that I can tell the whole truth and believe that they're smart and good enough to get the truth without me having to twist anything around. So that I can tell the truth of my story, good, bad, and ugly. I can embrace the parts of my case that aren't perfect, that I'm not trying to answer a law school exam and, you know, check every possible cause of action and make every possible argument, but that I can trust the jury and trust the case enough to distill it down to the actual core truths that we win with and tell those truths and accept life for what it is.
I love that. What I love about that is that you're saying credibility is not just something that I say or an action I take, but it's actually a mental state. I would almost say like an energetic state, but certainly a mind state of trust, that you're trusting the jury. And I think that is super important. And it really comes across in your body and your presentation if you're there to strike jurors, if you're there to embrace jurors. And I would say we can do both of those, but we certainly want to embrace those that end up on the panel.
Absolutely. And it's taken a lot of work. I used to think credibility was about the story and about the facts. And as I've matured in my trial presentations or my trial work, I've learned it's a lot more about my attitude, my energy flow, my thought work, I guess mindfulness work. And I think the biggest things is my self-talk and my meditation before trial, as opposed to, you know, that leads to the credibility in the courtroom. And because a lot of times things just come up you aren't prepared for. How do you handle them? And when you can be honest and truthful about it, it really helps. So kind of to wrap it up, if you have one piece of advice, each of you, for lawyers that are getting ready to try a tough case, what would you tell them?
I mean, sometimes you have no choice. You're always going to have a tough case. Every case has its difficulties. There is no such thing as a perfect case. And if there was, it probably wouldn't go to trial. So, you know, every case is different. You know, try to, before you start picking, try to understand how you want to close, what the law that's going to be read. You know, a lot of people don't. I start every trial with, what are my jury instructions? You know, where am I? Where do I need to end? So that I can pepper that throughout my trial and I can frame my questions appropriately. So, you know, it's a tough trial. They're going to come. It's part of it. You win, you lose. Hopefully you win more than you lose. But, you know, just you have to be ready to jump in. And if you prepare, you've done all you can. You can't change the facts on your case. All you can do and all your job is as a lawyer is to present them in the most effective and the most efficient way possible and hope for the best result. That's all you can do. So preparation is key. Try to always sharpen your skills. We actually built a full courtroom in our office and we leave it open to any plaintiff's attorney that wants to come. I actually had someone that was scheduled to come today, but he got tied up to put on his case and our team was going to cross-examine his witness. And we have a former judge that actually takes the bench and we do the whole thing. And it's open to any plaintiff lawyer that wants it. I've had people come in and use it and great. This case, the Hussein case, was actually the first one since our courtroom was built that we actually put through the courtroom and the whole thing and did the whole mock trial. So preparation is all you can control. And I would say if, you know, hard case, easy case, they're all going to have their difficulties. But if you can control your preparation, you've done your job.
Jessica?
I think I would say don't try too hard to overtry the case. I think it's an instinct in a tough case that you get kind of defensive and then you push too hard on things that you think are going to save you or push on the little things that you don't know if the jury is going to buy it or not. And then you risk overshooting it or losing your credibility. So I think you have to tread lightly in tough cases. And once you feel like things are going your way, you can ramp it up a little bit. But you have to feel the room and you have to start slow and you have to build on that and sort of figure it out as you go. But don't go in there pointing a bunch of fingers where jurors may not want to point fingers or you know, trying theories that you don't know if they're going to buy it or not. So that's the hard part, I think, with tough cases is holding back enough but knowing when to then step forward.
And those are, and I know she had some real injuries, and I know that she got them from this crash, but we had some challenges in this case. And so let's start with you mentioned one. One challenge was that the two vehicles did not actually make contact with each other. Any other challenges on liability?
Well, one of the other challenges that we had was the police officer was against us. He put in his report that it was our client's fault that she had lost control. And so we had to kind of overcome that as well.
Didn't the... Not just the police officer was against us, but the truck driver had a story that was trying to exonerate himself, and then the defense also hired their own crash reconstructionist.
Yes. So the defense was able to put together a story between what the driver said and their reconstructionist to say that our client was actually driving behind him, tried to come around the 18-wheeler as he's making his lane change, and she got in his way, which is why the crash happened.
Which wasn't true, but they still said it.
Yes. And it was hard to overcome. I mean, it was hard to say that didn't happen.
So that's the liability challenge. Now, you had some damages challenges. So she was really hurt. She got a lot of medical treatment. But when did that treatment start?
That treatment didn't start till a couple weeks after this crash. Actually, more than that. I think maybe 5 weeks after this crash.
Yeah, because she got in the crash on the way home for Thanksgiving. And then on Christmas break, she went to the doctor once. And then in February, she got an MRI, and then she really started treating. But even that, the first year and 10 months, it was just like conservative care, some therapy, and it wasn't until long after that she actually started getting the more invasive treatment, like a year and 10 months after the crash.
Yes. Yeah. She really didn't start getting any significant treatment until much later. And even after she started getting significant treatment, we had another gap there for about a year. And I think that's one of the challenges, though, coming with younger clients. I mean, you know, one, they don't believe that they're really that hurt, so they don't want to go. Two, they're busy with, you know, their lives and school, and they don't want to take the time out to go to the doctor. But, yeah. You know, those are all things that we had to explain.
So I want to start with how you overcame these challenges, and then I'll go into the trial itself. So let's start with the liability. You've got, you know, we've got our reconstructionists. They have the reconstructionists. They have the cop on their side. You know, we have our story. They have their story. How did you present – how did you solve that puzzle to show liability on the part of the tractor trailer?
I think what I decided to do was just to keep it as simple as possible. You know, we talk all the time about how confusion is the friend of the defense. And I feel like that's what was happening with stories about her coming from behind and who was really in the lane and who was where, you know, those were all the defense's stories. And I decided just to try to boil it down to just very simple that this is a lane change. It doesn't matter where she came from or what was happening, but all the facts are that we know she was here and he was here. And, you know, my opening was very short on liability because I said all it is he was going into her lane. He went into her lane. And there was no doubt about that. I mean, everybody agreed he went into her lane. And so that's what I tried to focus on mostly, was just keeping it as simple as possible for the jury and not confusing them with all these other stories.
And I think the fact that you were smart enough to not just get the pictures that our expert took, but to also have the other industry publications. And so the weakness of the publications is it's just a drawing. It is not real. But then when our expert does something, there's that argument, well, that's just the expert saying, and of course he's rigging it to come out the way you want it to. So I think when you combine with, like, this is what our expert showed, and it's also consistent with what's in the published literature, then it's just more believable.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree. And it gave our expert a lot of credibility, and it gave us credibility that we're not here just making these things up because this is what the result that we want, but this is really what the rules say.
And was there a lot of property damage on this case?
No, not at all. When she crashed, she had crashed into the median, but I mean, I think she hit a stop sign or a speed limit sign. And so there was a little dent in the bumper from the speed limit sign. But other than that, she didn't really hit anything. It was more the terrain that she was going in. It was, you know, it was a ditch. So that's kind of where we think more of the biomechanics came into play. But really no property damage. None from the truck, even.
Next, we turn to trial skills and strategy, focusing on the techniques that can make a real difference in the courtroom.
My last favorite thing on cross-examining defense doctors, I stole from Keith Mitnick. And that's when they say, well, they'll give you an injury, but they'll say, but it's a soft tissue injury that should have gotten better in 6 to 8 weeks. And you lock the doctor in there. If you're right, this is something that would get better in 6 to 8 weeks. And then you show the records that the pain didn't change after 6 or 8 weeks. And so, doctor, you're telling this jury that one day, somewhere between 6 weeks and 8 weeks, they went to bed with pain from this crash. And they woke up the next morning with the exact same pain, but it was from something else. I mean, there's no winning for them on that. Yeah. They either have to admit they're wrong, and they usually won't, or they just have to look like idiots. And most of them want to get paid on the next case to say the same thing, so they'll just choose to look like idiots, and then you've won.
One of the things I've seen you do, Michael, which is in cases, so I'm sure this doesn't only happen in our cases, but even when you have a client that's really badly hurt, right? They went to the emergency room. They were there for a month. They had all these kind of treatments and surgeries and all kinds of stuff. They still hire a medical doctor to say, well, they should be all better now, or they're fine, or whatever they're going to say. In those cases, I've seen you use the defense doctor to tell your story about what the client has actually been through. So what have you done with that? How do you do that when they're going to say, well, yeah, but they should be all better, even though they have all these bad injuries?
Yeah, so I had one, and again, it was a severe injury, you know, more than 20 broken bones, a severe traumatic brain injury. And the defense doctor, they hired him, and he went through, he didn't ever meet the client. He just reviewed all the records and said he got better. So I had just two things I did. I did one with one doctor, one with the other. So the one doctor that reviewed all the records, I just went through all the records, just the hospital records, and just did a drawing of the body, and I just drew every single injury. And he had this injury, he had that injury, he had severe traumatic brain injury, he had a broken bone here, he had a tooth broke off, and that tooth ended up in his lung, and they couldn't get it out. He had broken ribs, he had a broken arm, drew them all out on one outline. And then that was it. I didn't ask him about his opinions of my client getting better. And that case settled right before jury selection, but my plan was just to play that as a direct. They didn't do a trial cross, they're going to call him live. So the jury would have already heard him talk about all the injuries my client had. Now, if they want to bring him back to say he got all the way better, let them. And then they had another doctor that said, my client got all the way better. But he hadn't carefully reviewed all of the therapy notes that my client... He said his brain injury was miraculous recovery, and the brain injury was all the way better. And then I just made him read... Actually, I read to him and made him agree with me what it said, all the notes from that month where the therapist says he's still having memory problems, he's still having this problem, that problem, and just got him to look like he goes, well, I still think he's better. It was great. I mean, he was just, told he's relying on the records, but he hadn't read them all, and he's totally being contradicted by the records he's supposedly reviewed.
And the way to kind of head that off is say, generally, what kind of, if you know kind of what the treatment, you should know what the treatment history is, generally, what kind of conservative treatment do they have? Okay, they had chiropractic care. If you know the doctor has a tendency to want to go through every visit, say, about how many chiropractic visits do they have? 20. Okay, great. And write that down and then move on to the next thing. Okay, then they did imaging. Okay, what kind of images did they have?
Yeah.
So try to get them to talk more generally when they're talking about the treatment, as opposed to giving the specific, on this date, they had this procedure.
Yeah.
Here's all the technical terms associated with it.
Yeah, much better. Like, we tried a series of 3 epidural spinal injections, or we tried radiofrequency ablation. That didn't work, so we did a surgery. That's the big stuff. It's trying to get them to summarize, because when they go through every date and every treatment, it really loses the jury, and you also often highlight any kind of gaps or imperfections you have in your records.
Right. And one of the things that I like to do is I have one of those document cameras on my desk, so I can share my screen while I'm taking notes for the doctor. So it's notes for the jury, but it's notes for the doctor too. So the question at the top will be, what treatment did Joe endure? And then as we're writing it down, he'll get the point as I'm going through, when I'll say, what treatment did he have? Well, he had 27 chiropractic visits, and I'll just write chiropractic visits.
Yep.
And then did he have any imaging? Well, he had this, 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 and this. Okay. MRIs. Right. And so then as I start doing that, then the doctor will start getting it. Okay. I just want general, epidural steroid injections. And so then by the end of it, I have this cool exhibit that summarizes all the treatment, but it also helps keep the doctor from going back into the individual records and reading them.
And they're smart. It's just that they're used to communicating in the way that one doctor would communicate to another. And all that stuff would be very meaningful to a doctor. The exact date, exactly what they did and when, is very important to a doctor. It's not important to a jury.
Right, right. So then the next step after treatment is prognosis.
Yep.
So how do you ask about prognosis to a doctor? Do you just say, what's the prognosis?
So doctor, after all this treatment, you've done all the way up to the back surgery, are they cured? Well, how are they doing now? Well, more likely than not, reasonable medical probability, what does the future hold? Or what will they continue to endure in the future?
Yeah. And are they going to
And then you may ask, what treatment will they need in the future,
Right, right. And so, that's simple enough. You just, again, you want to keep it as general as possible. And most doctors aren't going to be able to say, well, on December 31st, 2027, he's going to need this procedure. I mean, it's never going to be that specific anyways on this part. So usually they can say generally, I think he's going to need another surgery, or he's going to need physical therapy for the rest of his life, or he's going to need whatever it is. The only warning I would give here is that if you don't have a life care planner in your case, you might need to get a little more specific.
Oh, yeah.
about the actual treatment that's needed. If you have a life care planner, then they're going to handle the specifics. But if you don't, and your doctor is going to be the one proving up your future care, it does probably need to get a little more specific.
Then you need to get costs and where they got the costs from and all that stuff in there. Absolutely. So what were y'all looking for in jury selection?
I mean, we were just looking for open minds. I mean, jury selection is, for me, it's, you know, everyone says it's, you know, deselection, which it is. But, you know, just trying to find if there are any monsters in the room. And that's the hardest part. You know, you don't want to have a sleeper in the room that just doesn't, is no matter what, is not going to like you, not going to like the case, or has a problem with certain things. So we were really just trying to see if people would be open to, number one, because we knew we were going to ask for big money, you know, open to bigger awards. And, you know, and then we were really going into, you know, I think laying the foundation for what our, what, and Jessica mentioned, we didn't go full conspiracy from the beginning, but we were kind of like pulling that thread to see if hopefully at some point during this trial we get a break and then we can go, you know, we can go with 2 feet. So it was just kind of laying the foundation of, you know, putting a little skepticism.
How did you do that?
So, I mean, really, it's just listening to the jurors. I mean, there's really no better that I've had, like no better, you know, way to describe it than just, you know, just try to develop some sort of relationship, get them comfortable, get their guard down, so that they can have a real conversation with you. We're in the Bronx. No one's got, you know, for the most part, no one really has problems with making monetary awards or gets shy about big numbers. You know, it was, we were trying to make it more so about, you know, how important is it for people to take care of their property, their premises, and, you know, why is it important? Is it important to you? How do you, what kind of work do you, I remember we had one custodian who I loved and he took such pride in his work, and I just kept talking to him so the rest of the room could hear, oh, every morning I do this and I'm very, no, that's my responsibility. I'm very diligent with how I maintain these buildings because why are you doing, oh, because people can get hurt. And then, you know, so we were trying to kind of build, they kicked him off the panel. They used one of their grips on him. But,
best expert witness you had though.
Yeah. He was good. He was great for us. Jessica, I'm sure you remember him because that was like your favorite witness, your favorite juror.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really the go back to the, I'm a big believer in, you know, build your tribe in selection. I'm sure we've all heard that. And that's kind of what I'm trying to do more and more. And with Jessica's help, we've been successful in doing it.
These moments look beyond the courtroom, showing leadership, perspective, and why sharing what we learn matters.
You know, one of the mantras at our firm is that we learn and we share what we learn. Oh. Now, I have heard that there are firms out there that don't share as freely as our firm does. I mean, we were always happy to share our forms and depots and outlines and things like that. You know, why is that such a big deal to you?
Karma. You know, I am here today because other great lawyers shared with me. I mean, 20-something years ago, I'm getting my first F-150 rollover roof crush case, and Michael Watts had just gotten a big verdict on an F-150 rollover roof crush case, and he tells his staff, I mean, he doesn't know me. He tells the staff to let me go to their office and go through all their trial exhibits and trial transcript so I could get the best exhibits to use, what go through the discovery. I mean, it's just incredible. He didn't have to do that. He didn't know me. You know, I'm in trial in March, and you know, at one point in the trial, we had a high-low agreement in place, and I had a certain ask. I wanted to know if I should change my ask because, you know, why ask for as much if I have a high-low? And so Joe Free picks up the phone and he talks me through the issues. You know, just people do it for me. I need to do it for other people.
I think that's really important, especially in our practice where we represent plaintiffs. And I think it goes a long way to where you started originally, that you really want the little guy, the injured person, to have the same representation as the major corporations. And that only works if we're sharing information, right?
Yep. I don't like the word the little guy, though.
I know.
And because I think that our people are not little people. I think they have the same worth and the same capacity, whether they realize it or not, as the CEO of the biggest corporations. And I think that we should never... I just think we, over the years, I've learned to really respect my clients and seeing the resiliency of my clients. It's actually taken a lot of pressure off at trial. Because, like, if a trial doesn't go well, they're going to find a way to survive. They're going to make it. And if it does go well, they're going to figure out what to do. And if you get them a bunch of money and they blow it, they're going to find a way to survive. Now, you give them good advice. You don't want that to happen. But respecting the resiliency of our clients and that there are whole, complete human beings. They're not broken. They're not powerless. They need help, and we're here to help them. But also, I want to see my client as big and as great. When I talk to lawyers that are outside of the law and discuss sharing, just not just lawyers, but other people in corporate America that are, I went to high school with or college with, and they're always like, well, how can you give away your IP? Well, how much money do they pay you to get that test that you ran? I'm like, well, I already paid for it. I already got paid for it when I resolved the case, so why would I charge them anything?
Well, and it's important that we help out our brethren, because if they are successful, then it's going to help us out, because the worst thing that we can have happen when we're at mediation and somebody said, well, you know, Joe Smith just lost a trial on this, you know, on this identical issue here. So therefore, your value is going to go down today. Well, if I've been able to help Joe Smith out by giving him some outlines or cross-examination ideas or crash testing that enables him to achieve success, it's going to benefit me in the long run as well.
This final moment reminds us that being a great lawyer begins with being a great person.
If you want to be a great trial lawyer, I mean, really a great trial lawyer, you ready? Be a great person. Be a great dad. Be a great son. Be a great mom. Be a great sister. Be a great friend. Just be the very best person you can, because when you live your life like that, A, it not only brings great joy, but jurors can pick up on that in a heartbeat. So that means how you treat the bailiff, how you treat the court staff, how you treat your paralegal, all of that is being measured by the jury. So look, point number one, be a great person. That's number one. Point number two I want to make. I've been very blessed with some really big verdicts for lawyers, many really big verdicts. Here's what I've learned. Kathy Bennett taught me this. The greatest verdicts you will have in your life are the moments you spend with your family. Okay?
These were some of the standout moments from Trial Lawyer Nation in 2025. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to bringing you more conversations, insights, and stories that matter in the year ahead.
Thank you for joining us on Trial Lawyer Nation. I hope you enjoyed our show. If you'd like to receive updates, insider information, and more from Trial Lawyer Nation, sign up for our mailing list at triallawyernation.com. You can also visit our episodes page on the website for show notes and direct links to any resources in this or any past episode. To help more attorneys find our podcast, please like, share, and subscribe to our podcast on any of our social media outlets. If you'd like access to exclusive plaintiff lawyer only content and live monthly discussions with me, send a request to join the Trial Lawyer Nation Insider Circle Facebook group. Thanks again for tuning in. I look forward to having you with us next time on Trial Lawyer Nation.
Each year, the law firm of Cowan Rodriguez Peacock pays millions of dollars in co-counsel fees to attorneys nationwide on trucking and commercial vehicle cases. If you have an injury case involving death or catastrophic injuries and would like to partner with our firm, please contact us by calling 210-941-1301 to discuss the case in detail and see where we can add value in a partnership. This podcast has been hosted by Michael Cowan and is not intended to, nor does it create, the attorney-client privilege between our host, guest, and any listener for any reason. Content from the podcast is not to be interpreted as legal advice. All thoughts and opinions expressed herein are only those from which they came.